SBS Radio.
Well, it's that time of the week again where we welcome NITV science and technology editor to join us to talk all things science and tech. Welcome to the program, Ray Johnston.
Thanks for having me, Kerry Lee.
Deadly to have you back again to talk all things science and tech. And first up, you're going to tell us something that we might already know about our instinctive gut feeling. There's some news that's come out this week.
Yeah, science has shown that it comes from your brain, not from your gut. Yeah, they've pinpointed it. So this is new research. It's from the University of Queensland, and it's really shown why we can, you know, take someone at face value and why we develop those gut feelings, those instincts about a person within a split second. So past research has shown that the amygdala, that is a really tiny almond-shaped part of the brain, the amygdala, and it responds to emotions and threats, but we haven't known until now how fast it does that. So this study looks specifically at the speed of processing emotions. And it found that that little almond-shaped amygdala in your brain, it's receiving information about how other people's facial expressions make us feel within 2/10 of a second. But because we're processing emotions really rapidly, but our awareness is taking place slightly later on, it takes about 3/10 of a second, they found out, for us to be aware of what we're seeing and what we're feeling. So that is the science behind this gut feeling that we have. It starts in our brain and then we catch up. So we have this feeling of, oh, something's not quite right here, because we've picked it up with that little amygdala in our brain.
Gotta love that. Some new research coming out. I always thought it was coming from our gut. How wrong was I, Ray?
Well, you know, it kind of does feel like it's in our gut. And yeah, we've got pretty good instincts about feeling, us black fellas, about people and our feelings and our instincts about people. So maybe we, in particular, have a highly evolved amygdala in our brain. We can
maybe
just pick it up quicker.
Perhaps we do. Perhaps that is the case. Now we go from talking about our brain and science to emu populations. What can you tell us about this? Apparently, emu populations are projected to remain stable into the future.
So scientists at Western Sydney University and also the University of Tasmania, they've mapped out the whole history of where emus have been. And they're doing this to work out where they're likely to be in the future. And they looked at the next 50 years. So looking back in time, they found that past climate changes over the last 6,000 years, it meant that emus expanded northward across Central Australia, and they're hanging out less on the east coast, on the east of the Great Dividing Range.
Mm.
So the researchers said that climate change is a large part of why these changes have happened.
Okay.
And also the future for east coast emu populations, they're potentially pretty fragile because there's been changes in rainfall patterns over the last several thousand years, and obviously recently as well, which is keeping them away in most part from the east coast. So the emus that are also left on the east coast, there's like dwindling populations of them.
Mm.
They're right at the limit of how suitable that climate is for them. So if it gets any, you know, outside of their comfort zone, they're just going to take off west and north. And there's also threats from predators, and there's habitat loss because there's a lot of, you know, urbanisation happening. There's a lot of building happening, and it's putting a lot of pressure on those populations. And it's gotten pretty bad. It's gotten to the point where emu populations up in the northeast, they're listed as endangered. And we really need to be putting in some efforts to conserve those remaining emu populations. It's really, really important. So the researchers really hope that this study helps highlight that we need to be looking after our east coast emus, or they're all going to take off out west and we're not going to see them ever again.
A really important science story to come out this week. And now we go from emus to talking about the world's oldest cave art, which has been discovered in Indonesia, I understand.
Yeah, when I first heard this story, I got my back up a bit and went, hang on a minute, how come they've got the world's oldest cave art? We've got the world's oldest caves. This can't be right.
Right, so I got on the phone.
I got on the phone to a few people to work it out. But what they've found is it's thought to be the oldest rock art in the world, and it's been uncovered on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi. And it's been dated to at least 45,500 years old, and it's of the fighting Sulawesi warty pigs, and they've been drawn in red ochre. And where they've been found is this cave in a valley that's enclosed by these really steep limestone cliffs. And you can only get to this cave through this really narrow passage during the dry season, because the valley floor gets completely flooded in the wet and you can't get to this cave. And there's a community living there, the Bugis community, and they say that this cave has never been visited by Westerners before until this team went in there at Griffith University.
Wow.
So I spoke with a few experts about it, and they believe that there may be ties between this art that has been found and our own rock art. So I spoke to Adam Brum, who was the archaeologist at Griffith University who led the team into the cave, and he told me how Sulawesi, it's the largest island in a chain of isolated islands between the Ice Age continental landmasses of Asia to the west and Australia, and they were joined together during low sea levels in the Ice Age. And he told me that Aboriginal ancestors must have travelled through this area at some point. Just a given. And I also spoke with David Johnston, who is the director of Aboriginal Archaeologists Australia, and he told me that our rock art specialists around the world will compare this art with our Australian rock art, which obviously goes back a long time as well. He said to me that no doubt probably next week we'll find sites here that are older, but who's competing? That was his exact words on that one. But the thing is that rock art is really hard to date. It's hard to get a definitive date on it. But this rock art, because it's produced in limestone caves, it can be dated using what's called uranium analysis. And they look at the calcium carbonate deposits, which they nickname cave popcorn. So there's little deposits all over the cave. Wow. They form naturally on the cave wall surface. And yeah, they create this little bumpy surface. In this cave, a little cave popcorn, it had formed on the rear foot of one of the pigs after it had been painted. So they were able to date that to be 45,500 years old. That means that the painting underneath it must be older than 45,500 years old. And that's how they work out the age of the painting. Pretty interesting stuff. I love this story.
True deadly. Gotta love that. Now we go from ancient cave art to governments who are setting targets designed to lower the salt content of packaged foods. Tell us more about this, sis.
Yeah, so back in 2015, the federal government, they established what they called the Healthy Food Partnership, and it was designed to tackle the issue of diet-related diseases. But they put out all these targets. You know, there's 27 targets for sodium levels, 5 targets for saturated fat levels. They weren't released until May 2020, so it just kind of sat there for 5 years. So what the George Institute have done is they've taken these targets and they've analysed a year's worth of grocery purchases from a sample of around 10,000 households in 2018. And then they linked that data with the George Institute's packaged food and beverage database that they have, which is called Food Switch. And they used all these numbers to calculate the sodium or salt content of all the products that were purchased. So instead of seeing what happens in the future, they just looked at what happened in the past, ran all the data and went, hey, this isn't going to be good enough. Because this study found that even if those targets that had been set by the federal government were achieved, you know, salt purchases, they'd be reduced by just 3.5%, which isn't enough to tackle any of the health-related issues that we have. So they've suggested that if Australia adopted the same targets that are used in the UK, that the salt purchases, you know, the reduction in salt purchases, that would more than double, because a broader range of products are covered by the UK targets. There's only a limited number of products that are included in this plan. But we've got more than 6 million Australian adults. That's one in three people that have high blood pressure. And reducing salt consumption, that's been calculated, it would save thousands of lives every year, as well as millions in healthcare costs, but that's obviously not as important as the thousands of lives. Mm. But as it exists, you know, this program, it's just unlikely to do anything that we need it to do to make us healthier and happier. So I don't know, maybe we just need to take matters into our own hands, read the salt content on the labels of the food that we're picking up and make some good decisions with what we're putting in our bodies.
I wish I could do that more, but I don't do that enough, is read the labels of what we're putting into our own bodies, Ray. And it's tough.
It is hard too, because even like I didn't find out until recently, you know, just like Slurpees, like frozen Coke,
mm-hmm, brain freezers,
huge amount of salt in them.
Fair
you
income.
Wouldn't think so, yeah, because it's what stops it from freezing.
Wow!
You know, if you put salt on ice, it stops it from melting. Rather, you know, if you put salt on ice, it stops it from melting.
Wow!
So they have to up the salt content in the frozen Coke so that it doesn't just melt as soon as you put it into the cup.
That's incredible. Wow.
So it's hiding all over the place, that salt, and yeah, it's just not good for our hearts.
Certainly not, and especially for our Indigenous community members across Australia as well. We always want to keep healthy, hey Ray?
That's it.
Now we go from talking about salt to something I know nothing about, and we're going to be talking about carnivorous sponges. But first up, what are carnivorous sponges? I've got no idea, sis.
So you've got marine sponges, and, you know, we know a little bit about marine sponges. They're those spongy things that wash up on the beach, and they filter seawater for, you know, organic particles, and they have lots of toxic chemical compounds that are inside them that they deal with. So they're really, really useful for the medical profession, actually. So they're filters for the sea, and they just kind of float around soaking up all of the terrible toxic things put out by other animals and plants and microbes. But a few decades ago, something called carnivorous sponges were found.
Wow.
And they were discovered in the deep sea, and they don't filter feed through seawater. And they don't have the cellular structure to be able to do that, but instead they've evolved as predators, and they catch and digest their prey directly.
Ugh, so they get little dangerous.
Small they get little small crustaceans, you know, ending up in their bodies, in their little structures, and they're just digested then and there. So they're fascinating little creatures. And we've just found three more new versions of this sponge, more little species in the Great Australian Bight. So they're found 3 kilometres below the surface of the water, and they're meat eaters, which I just find fascinating for a sponge, because you don't think of a sponge as being a meat eater.
Absolutely not, right?
Right. Yeah. But this species, it's been described by the Queensland Museum scientists, and they're the first recorded carnivorous species from South Australia. And this means that we've got 25 versions of this carnivorous sponge in Australia now. And it was actually collected by the CSIRO on a voyage back in 2017, but it takes a while for scientists to get around to studying and discovering things from these things collected on this voyage. And it really goes to show how much of our deep oceans are yet to be explored, because these are really unique. They're only found in this particular region of the Great Australian Bight, which is actually a region that was slated for deep sea oil exploration. So lucky that didn't happen, or we never would have found these carnivorous sponges.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And these new species, they look incredible. I'll actually pop up a photo on my Instagram for you, Kerry Lee, and for the listeners as well, so that you can see what these things look like, because they're amazing.
Yes, please.
They look like they're made out of glass or toffee, and they kind of look like little trees. Mm. They're just absolutely fascinating, and it's really exciting to be discovering these. You know, sponges are just fascinating. I know they don't sound like they would be, but, you know, those qualities that the sponges possess, you know, the things that they can do inside the ocean, have meant that they've been able to be used as, you know, by scientists as options for all sorts of treatments, including potential cancer treatments. So it's a medicine. You know, it's a natural source of medicine. And I'm just fascinated to see what comes out of the discovery of these three as well.
I'm excited too. And thank you for educating me all about carnivorous sponges. I feel a lot better off now, my sister.
No worries. I'm glad I could get you excited about sponges.
You could. I'm going to check out your Instagram page for that picture as well. But so no deadly today to talk all things science and tech. We talked about our instinctive gut feelings, emu populations and climate change, the world's oldest cave art discovered in Indonesia, and good to talk about how government targets are designed to lower the salt content of packaged foods and how this will make a difference to the health of Australians. And, of course, deadly to hear about the carnivorous sponges found in the Great Australian Bight. It's been an absolute pleasure today, Ray Johnston. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, always great to talk to you, sis. Thanks for having me.
We'll talk again next week. Same time, same place, sis.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.